show was recorded as a video as well. You can see both of those hours at redicemembers.com and the first hour at redice.tv. Click into the TV section or at youtube.com/redice radio. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Henrik. I'm from Sweden. This is Red Ice Radio. Always a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for tuning in today. This is Alt Media on the alt-right, more or less. Redice.tv is the website. And today on the show, we have retired professor of psychology at California State University Long Beach, Kevin MacDonald. He has a PhD in behavioral science. His research has focused on developing evolutionary perspectives on culture, developmental psychology and personality theory, and also ethnic relations, or what's known as group evolutionary strategy. He's the author of Culture of Critique, and today he runs the Occidental Observer and publishes the Occidental Quarterly. Good to have you back on the show, Kevin. Thanks you for coming on.
I always enjoy coming, Henrik, and thanks for a very nice introduction.
Well, you bet. Thank you so much. It's great to have you here today. We have a lot of things lined up today that we want to get into and talk more about. One of the thing, of course, I wanted to discuss with you a little bit is the AMA that you did last night on Reddit. How did that go?
That was the first time for me, and it was actually very enjoyable. It was intense. I mean, they told me that just 1 hour would be enough, but you know, there are 150 some comments, and I stayed on there for 2 hours, and I felt pretty comfortable with almost all the questions. Answered pretty much everything except some at the end. I just sort of ran out of gas there, but yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it.
It's a younger crowd, obviously. Are they on point in some of the concerns, do you think?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, they are younger, and that's typical of the alt-right, though. I mean, the alt-right is a young man's movement, and that's good, because these guys, in general, they're smart, they get it, and, you know, they aren't intimidated by the usual things that so many adults are. I mean, so many, you know, I think a lot of people, when they get older, they get more conservative or something. They don't want controversy, or they don't want to say things. These guys, they got it going on. And I really appreciate being able to answer the questions. I mean, I think that's the thing. I mean, a lot of these people, I hadn't done a lot of reading in my stuff. So I could just give sound bites, you know, just sort of brief summaries, and then I put in a lot of links to to longer things, and so they could do some reading. It's very encouraging. The whole movement's encouraging, and you know, it's just very much very, very heartening to look out and at the crowds at the National Policy Institute, say American Renaissance, I understand, is the same way, and to see these people, it's just great.
Yeah, exactly. There's been a lot of rise of the whole. There's been a lot of energy behind the alt-right this year, at least, of course, because of the fact that Hillary has talked about it. She has, you know, spoken out against Pepe. It's very strange, to be honest, because usually you would just think that these kind of high-profile people, if you will, would just leave these topics alone. Maybe that they would criticize maybe like neo-Nazism or white nationalism or something like that. But this is fairly unique. Why do you think that they're addressing it?
Well, I think they are, because we are the only group, the only intellectual identifiable group that is supporting Donald Trump. So I think their motive basically is to do something against Donald Trump. And, you know, actually, before Donald Trump ran, I was very depressed about our prospects here on the alt-right, because we didn't get any media coverage to speak of. You didn't even hear that term. But then it started happening. You saw, you know, articles and major, you know, news outlets, New York Times, Washington Post, just all over the place. So Mother Jones, Counterpunch. And the thing is, they were, you know, interviewing people like Richard Spencer, Jared Taylor, and so on. And that was just a huge plus. But then I think Hillary Clinton did think she could score some points. I mean, she was, you know, contextualizing it by saying, you know, this is part of the racism of Donald Trump. This is a disaster. This is horrible. And I think it was great for us. I heard that there was a huge upsurge in Google searches. The National Policy Institute got a whole lot more recognition because of that. And I don't think it's really hurt Donald Trump. In fact, one of the big messages to me with Donald Trump's victory in the primaries was he was being called a racist and all that all through the primaries, and it didn't seem to make a dent. It seems to be losing its force these days, and that's so such a good thing, and it's so great to see these young people on Reddit and various things. They don't get intimidated by being called a racist or even a neo-Nazi or anything like that. That is all to the good. So I think we are entering a new era. Unfortunately, I do think that they are going to try to put it back in the bottle. They're going to put it back in the bottle if they can. I saw something today on Twitter that people were trying to sanction journalists who talk to the alt-right, you know, and I do think if Hillary wins, there will be an attempt to do that. But we are on the map way more than we used to be. And we have a big, very big online presence. And it's attractive to young people. One of the questions on Reddit last night was somebody was asking me, he was under the impression that I disapproved of PayPay and all that.
Right.
And that's simply false. I think PayPay is great. I think that it gives a style to things. We have to have a sort of sense of aesthetics. We have to have a sense of, and words like cuckservative have been so effective and so appropriate because, you know, they get to the fundamental issue that so many people, so many white people are cuckolded. You know, they have no problem with becoming a minority. They can see the disaster that's unfolding. They see that we can't, you know, we're getting to the point where we can't elect a president anymore and soon we'll be a minority and so on. And we are being cuckolded. And so this has been a beautiful term. And PayPay is just great. I mean, it's just.
Humor is important. Sort of humor is important.
Yeah, it's become a symbol. And that's what we need. We need a symbol. And I just got to laugh a lot. And, you know, you see him in so many different guises. You know, he's got guns or he's got a gas mask on or he's dressed different ways. So it's just really great what people are doing with that. And I think it's, you know, we need graphic art. And that's what we got here with that. Every movement needs graphic art. And it's sort of playful. But, it gives us a playful edge. It's not like a hard edge kind of thing, you know, where we're. Easily depicted as haters. I mean, PayPay's a fraud, for heaven's sake.
You know, well, they're trying, Kevin. I mean, look at you. Probably heard the ADL trying to declare him a hate symbol.
Yeah, of course, there they are. But you expect that the ADL is going to go after anything that they think could possibly be a problem. And yeah, they actually have some of those memes that you see down there.
It's hilarious, though, in terms of the fact that this is, I mean, it's so humorous and they are trying to, I think they just look stiff in the eyes of the younger crowd. They're like, waiting for something of a true counterculture to come along, you know? So I think this actually attracts more people.
And that's the thing. This is a true counterculture and it's attractive to young people. And that's what that's got to scare them. I mean, I know when I first went to meetings, particular organization, it was all these 80-year-old guys who had immigrated here from Germany after World War II. And, it was just a very different scene. Now you go to the same organization, go to something like National Policy Institute, or you go on Reddit or something like that, or Twitter, and it's these young guys. And that's such a breath of
fresh air. And girls too, women.
Yeah, and more women, and that is also something we definitely need. We can't turn off women. We have to get them involved because, you know, we certainly have their best interests at heart. This current regime, you think about what's going on in Europe with all the rape. You think about the Islamization, where oppressing women is definitely a big part of the culture. We are on the side of women for sure, and I think people will understand that as time goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's so many exciting things that are going on right now, and despite the fact that they're trying to, I think one of the main reasons why they're kind of attacking the alt-right is because, as you say, they're simply trying to attach that to Trump so that they can demonize Trump and make him, you know, seem less plausible. But as you said, he doesn't seem to work. What did you think of the debates? Speaking of Trump.
The debate, I was a little disappointed in Donald Trump. It's been sad, I guess, and I wouldn't be too surprised. He didn't prepare all that much. That seems to be like his thing. And there were a lot of openings that he did not take advantage of. And he could have thrown. I mean, this moderator was very biased. This what's his name? Lester
Holt, right?
Yeah, Lester Holt. And he was so biased. And it was so obvious.
Yeah.
But you can't let him get away with that. I mean, he was, you know, well, he wants to focus on Trump's taxes. It was good that he said, I'll release my taxes when she releases the 33,000 emails. But at the same time, he could have equally said, if you want to talk about corruption, talk about the Clinton Foundation, talk about the fact that those emails were used to cover up the ones that she's erased or things were used to cover up the pay for play from the State Department. And he could have interjected those things. And I think he will in the future. There were a lot of missed opportunities. But at the same time, what's heartening is that so far I haven't seen any polls that she's gotten a bump up in this as a result of this. I mean, the only poll I've seen, Trump actually increased his lead in the Los Angeles Times poll. And, you know, that poll has always kind of favored Trump more than the others. But still, the fact is that I don't yet see any loss for Trump, even though, you know, the mainstream media pundits are all saying that Clinton won. And I've even read that Trump's own staff is saying that Trump could, you know, did not do that as well. And I agree, he didn't do as well as he could have. But I don't think it'll hurt him. I pray it does not hurt him. We need this guy. And he's a flawed candidate, always has been a flawed candidate. But, you know, we have to hope for the best here. I'm still confident about the election.
Yeah, very good. Now, we can return and talk more about Trump later. One of the things I just want to squeeze in here in the beginning is your attempt to basically get the University of Chicago to publish a couple of ads in some of their college papers. Let's talk about their hypocrisy a little bit and what you know about the history of the University of Chicago when it comes to the free speech issue.
Yeah, so someone contacted me who wanted to put out ads in the college newspapers. And I thought that's a great idea. You know, we haven't really tried that before. I understand that Jared Taylor tried that a while ago and was not successful. But, you know, things are different now. But actually, the climate on campus, as we all know, is extremely politically correct these days. But the University of Chicago was chosen as one of our targets because the University of Chicago has, you know, tried to present itself as this font of this protector of free speech. I mean, in August, the president of the university and the dean came out with very highly publicized. The president's statement was in the Wall Street Journal. The dean wrote this letter to all the students. We're not going to go along with safe spaces. You know, you could come to college, expect to be challenged. Don't expect professors to, you know, be inhibited about what they say just because of all this. So we thought, hey, we should send it to the University of Chicago, right? I mean, if they really believe in free speech, well, they should accept us.
We
try to be objective. We try to marshal facts based on scientific studies and so on. And, you know, we are written at a fairly high level that would engage college students. And my God, you know, you'd think that this would be perfect, but you know, nothing doing. They would not publish it. The student newspaper would not publish it. We sent letters to the dean and to the president, and they have not responded. They are not going to do anything. So, you know, it's a sham. You know, these guys, the president at university makes like $3.4 million a year.
I read that. Amazing.
That is just amazing. And these guys are all about, you know, their big salaries and the power they have at the university. And they know darn well there are things that they cannot do. So they can parade themselves as defenders of free speech and all that. But, you know, the reality is they're just shills for this corrupt establishment. They don't really question that. And in his statement, which you have on the screen right now, he says that they, the purpose of the university is to provide a critical pathway where students can fulfill their potential and all that. And so you have to promote free expression. But notice one word summarizes that process, questioning. They have to be questioning. But notice they include inclusiveness. Universities just have to be inclusive. Apparently, that can't be questioned. So how inclusive should universities be?
Right.
Yeah, you know, and that's the issue. I mean, universities are just this hotbed of radical, intense, aggressive, physically aggressive political correctness now. I mean, just recently at the University of Missouri, they had a campus conservative organization had a meeting, and these leftists came in there. They're yelling, they're screaming, interrupting the meeting. The same thing has happened, I think, at the University of Michigan. You know, it's endemic now. And so there's one I saw just today where this graduate student was saying that he's talking about some conservative leader. I think it was at the University of Missouri, one of those two places, saying, you know, you have to watch out when you're walking around campus, just physically threatening him that you might be attacked. And that's the level of intimidation that we see at universities these days. And so it's no surprise that these guys are caving in. You know, it's very sad commentary. And there's huge hypocrisy here. And these guys, you know, will not stand up for free speech unless it's, you know, sort of maybe a little bit. I don't know. I'm not really sure exactly what kinds of free speech they would allow.
Right.
You know, if they're not going to allow us, what would they say? Maybe, you know, kind of, you know, libertarian conservatism, that might be okay. I don't know.
Right.
As long as you don't question the basic thing about immigration, multiculturalism, you know, the sort of moral imperative of whites becoming a minority, that's the kind of thing you can't talk about. And the University of Chicago is no different in that regard. I just posted one just before I came on the air here about Pepperdine University. We also submitted that to Pepperdine. Now, they didn't make any big statements about how they were into free speech, but they did actually accept the ad, and they ran the ad, and I couldn't believe it, but they did. But then somebody notified the person in charge to say, look what you just posted, and this is horrible. And so she backtracked. She wrote this big apology. It was too late to take our ad out. But she apologized about this, her mistake. She called it a mistake, an oversight, was abjectly apologizing because she felt terrible. She felt sick. She came to our website and looked at the articles and just felt terrible that she had done this. And because she didn't even read our stuff before she did this. And then now she gets this. And so then we, you know, I wrote a reply to that. You know, I wanted to, you know, as a letter to the editor. I just, you know, criticizing this. And I try and make it an academic tone in referring to some academic articles and stuff. I refer, for example, to Jonathan Haidt's work on moral communities. I mean, the university has become a moral community. And what that means is people within an in-group feel that they are morally entitled. They're the one, they're good. And everybody outside that is bad. So you have findings like 90-some% of professors in the area of social psychology are Democrats. You know, they would identify as being a liberal. And like 3% identify as a conservative, or even less than that. And you know that even those conservatives are what we would call cuckservatives. They don't really believe in, you know, that whites have interests or anything like that. They're probably more like libertarian, maybe, or, you know, maybe they really like Ron Paul or something like that. So, you know, that's what we're up against at universities. And so I tried to write an article that I thought would actually make them feel a little bad about what they did. But, you know, they just wrote back to me just today, actually, saying, no, we're not going to publish that. We don't want to propagate this kind of stuff. And that's where it's at. I mean, it's an unthinking, reflexive feeling of moral superiority. You have to understand that at the basis of this, they feel that they are doing the right thing. And of course, in the back of their mind, they understand if they contravene this, if they published my stuff, if they, you know, published an honest discussion of these issues in their journal or in their newspaper, it would be a disaster for them, you know, socially on campus. These guys are journalism students. Guess what? If you're a journalism student, you got to know that, you know, this is one of those professions that's 90-some% liberal.
Exactly.
And you're not going to get a job if you're known as a conservative. So these guys know, you know, they're careerists at heart, and they're trying to say the right thing.
Well, what do you know about the history of some of these universities? I mean, were they prominent in helping to kind of fight free speech? I don't know if we go back to the 60s and 70s, maybe they fought women's issues even before that, right? But they've positioned themselves in being this new kind of conservative gatekeeping culture that they criticized so much in the 50s and 60s, right?
Right. There's been a huge shift here, where in the 50s and 60s, early part of the 60s especially, you know, universities were part of the McCarthyite thing, and they were, you know, having professors sign loyalty oaths because there were professors in the Communist Party, you know, and Americans were very concerned about that. They were concerned about communists and the government and so on. And universities went along with that. But then in the 1960s, of course, you had the triumph of the left. And ever since then, you know, free speech has not really been the first thing their first value. They don't really value free speech anymore. The left was a big champion of free speech in the 1950s when communists were being hauled up in front of committees and forcing people to sign loyalty oaths and so on. Now that they are in power, no way. They are not that way. And I would say that in general, the people on the left are in the lead now in opposing free speech. And if you get one or two more, just one more Supreme Court justice that's on the left, that's going to be the end of the First Amendment.
Right.
Because people like Elena Kagan, they've already written opinions clearly supporting restrictions on free speech. And the restrictions they support have to do with diversity type issues, you know, hate speech, so-called.
Right.
Those are the kinds of things they want to get rid of. And that would mean they would try to shut down the Axel Observer. They would try to shut down Red Ice Radio and everything like it. They would and take us off of Twitter and the whole thing. And you bet they would love to do that. The ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, the Jewish organizations, they have routinely opposed free speech. Again, these same organizations in the 1950s were all in favor of free speech because so many Jews actually were brought up in front of these committees in Congress and asked about their communist connections. But that's not the case now. Jewish organizations are entirely on board with restrictions on free speech, whether it's in this country, Australia, Europe, Canada, wherever. This is the new reality.
Well, there's a couple of things here I think that's very important, the issue that you bring up. We're really at a fork in the road, at a point now in terms of the history of the internet, where it could go one way or the other. There's number of programs that are being implemented on the bigger sites, right? YouTube has this Heroes program, right, where they basically are trying to kind of outsource the censorship to create a community of these heroes, as they call it, that are going to be able to report. It's even this level system, which reminds you of some kind of initiation of a cult or something, where you can ascend up the levels, right, be like higher up as a you know, a hero that has 500 points or whatever. And if you get this, you can mass report videos and all these kinds of things, right? Remarkably, though, there was a tremendous amount of backlash so far. I think even the thumbs down on the YouTube itself, the video that described this, were like 98% negative, thumbs down on it. So people are aware of it. But Twitter, as you say, has started to censor. Facebook, we know for a long time, has been doing it. And even now, I think in just a couple of days, there's a potentiality that Obama might hand over the control of the internet over to the UN. So there's a number of factors here that is basically, you know, leading to the potential great clampdown, you know?
Certainly. And again, to mention the ADL, they have a program now that will censor it, and they try to give it to schools and with quite a bit of success, and parents and so on. But the ADL would love to be able to censor the internet. There's a lot of pressure on Facebook and Twitter and so on. Andrew Joyce is one of the writers at Oxfam Observer, and he deals with Jewish issues. He's an historian, he's a PhD. And he got a Twitter account just a little while ago, like a month ago, and he started just posting, these pictures of Jewish activists in the academic world, in the media, and other areas. That's all they were, and he described what they did in a brief, 140 character limit. He got banned right away, and I was kind of shocked at that. And they got back on somehow, but he's preventing people from forwarding his messages because he's that's what happened. People would forward these things, they would retweet them, and then they would get around, and the activists would come down on them. But that can happen. I guess Milo's been banned from Twitter,
right?
And that was just for saying things about this black actress that wasn't even what you call racist or anything. I mean, she's not the most attractive woman in the world, let's face it. And he said some things about her. I mean, maybe a little tasteless or something, but there you go. I mean, it's just amazing.
Well, Twitter have been prouding themselves on the fact that they didn't censor, right? They didn't attack people. There was very much, it's good and bad with that. We understand that there's, for example, people have, they can post pornography and these kinds of things on Twitter, unfortunately, but that just kind of comes with the territory, right? You can't just, shut people down because there's something you don't happen to agree with. So you got to take the good with the bad. But I think we're entering into a new period here right now. And it's going to be very interesting where this is going to develop, because I think the ascendancy of the alt-right, a potential win by Trump, of course, can actually turn that away. But let's assume that Hillary gets in. I think we're in a full clampdown mode at that point.
I am terrified of what would happen if Hillary gets in. I know that some people I've talked to, they have reservations about Trump. I get it. He's not the perfect guy, but my
God. Of course,
you have to support him in the election here. This is there is just no choice. And then this woman will destroy the First Amendment. And even that's a higher priority, I would say, even than guns or anything else for her. But the First Amendment is the critical thing. And they will shut down. They will censor Twitter. They will censor Facebook. They will censor it all. The internet has been the big chink in their armor. The alt-right thrives on the internet. It is a child of the internet, you might say. It never would have happened without the internet. You think back 30 years ago in the 1980s, you had people who would start up some kind of newsletter, and all they could do is mail it out in a brown paper envelope or something, because it was that kind of, you just couldn't communicate. But now, boy, this has been a huge for us, And then you had the skillful, the Pepe memes, and everything's, was really fashionable and attractive and cutting edge and all that. And it's exciting. But that's what they're going to have, a big priority for them is to shut that down. No question about it.
Very good. Now there's a number of other issues that I also wanted to get into with. We can continue, as I said, to talk more about Trump and how you see this. But one of the things I actually want to get into is, of course, kind of your main work of what you've been doing many years, which is to kind of observe and monitor Jewish interests, and also specifically how that relates in the modern era to issues like immigration and these kinds of issues. And I wanted to actually play a clip for you, Kevin, and get your comments on it from this organization, IsraAid. Lana and I did a video about this just the other week on our TV show. But I want to play it to you, and then we can come back and comment on this afterwards. So here we go.
Every day, thousands of refugees arrive on this shore. Most are fleeing the Syrian civil war, hoping to resettle in Europe. Waiting to help them on the beaches of Greece are the last people the Syrians might expect. Volunteers from Israel.
My name is Tali Shaltiel. I'm here with Israel, an Israeli-based NGO.
My name is Majida Kardosh. I'm here as a medical team. I work as a nurse.
My name is Iris Adler. I live in Tel Aviv. I just finished med school in Tel Aviv University. I came here through Israel to be on the coast as a doctor.
My name is Manal Chhadi. I'm from Nazareth, and I'm the team lead of Israel in Greece.
Our job here is to receive the boats of the refugees that are coming from the Turkish side to the Greek side. There are many, many volunteers on the beach, not many medical teams.
On the line from the Turkish side, they're going through a lot of problems. Their smugglers there are asking them to pay between $1,000 to $5,000 per person. A lot of time they're just shoving them into boats that should fit 50 people, but there are 150 people on the boat. They just leave them midway through the sea and they tell them, you find your own way to Greece, we're not responsible on you. Or they fill like half a tank of gas and they just leave them in the middle of the sea.
What we do is go to Hind Point with binoculars, searching and scanning the water, and you start looking for this black with orange dots in the view. And then it comes nearer and you start seeing the rubber boat and all the people on it. It's like one, two, three, it begins. It's a few minutes of chaos, taking off the babies, people screaming, shouting, helping them, you know. A lot of them don't know how to swim, they're afraid from the water.
Looking at the refugees so we can see who is in need of medical help, and I start shouting, "Min badu doktor, who need a doctor," in Arabic. And so this is the time that we start giving treatment. After that, we start giving them food and water, warm clothes, something to eat, to drink. After that, I take the map. We have a map that we translate on it in Arabic, explain to them what is the next step. You know, they don't know where they are, okay? So the first thing that I tell them that they are in Lesbos Island in Greece, because some of them, they had like no idea where they are.
We brought a team from Israel, which is Arab speaking, and the effect was amazing.
Hearing your language is very important to them, and then getting the instructions where to go, what to do next, what are the next steps, because they have a lot of uncertainty.
And although Israel and Syria are technically at war, none of that matters here on the beach.
Usually when they get to the beach, they're just happy to see people waiting for them, giving them help and food and clothes and medical treatment if they need. Sometimes they realize who we are and they're just happy to see us, and they hug us and kiss us, and it's very exciting.
Men kissing me like I'm their daughter, you know, on the forehead, saying thank you, saying that I would never have thought that I'm going to receive treatment or be able to speak to from an Israeli doctor.
All right, there's more, of course, to that, Kevin, but I find it pretty remarkable, to be honest, that Israel has the capability of going to Greece in this way and welcoming in refugees into Europe, while Israel itself has one of the hardest policies when it comes to immigration and letting people into their country. What's your initial impression of this?
It's so heartwarming, isn't it?
Right.
It's just horrible. I mean, this hypocrisy, the Jewish hypocrisy on the subject of refugees and immigration, is just astounding. And, you know, every Jewish organization in Europe, we've had articles on that in Oxfam Observer, every Jewish organization in America, gung-ho pro-refugee, gung-ho pro-immigration. And as you say, Israel, you cannot simply go into Israel. They are not going to accept refugees. They have taken a tough stand on African migrants who've come up there. They have put them on airplanes and put them back to Africa. They, you know, as they said, they're at war with Syria, but they love the idea of Syrians going to Europe. And again, this coincides with the policies and the attitudes of all these Jewish organizations. Fundamentally, they want to have an end to Europe as a place for Europeans. And that's, you know, it's their ethnic interest. And it's so nice to be able to clothe your ethnic interests as humanitarianism and altruism. But actual observing, I think we have 80 some articles on that. We have a topic on that, Jewish double standards when it comes to this, because you just can't find a Jewish organization that doesn't take a positive view about immigration, multiculturalism, and so on. And fundamentally, that's the big reason why they don't trust Donald Trump. They don't like what he said about immigration and about refugees. I mean, he's condemned Hillary Clinton for wanting to increase refugees by 500%. He has talked about a ban on Muslim immigration. And it's just, you know, it's just a radically different thing. And so, yes, we have explored this topic. And it's, I've often said to people, this is something a four-year-old can see.
Right.
A four-year-old can understand that this is hypocrisy, that you want all these different people in European countries. You don't want the other people in Israel. You don't want a true multicultural Israel. That's the hypocrisy. They don't really have universal humanitarian values. They have very ethnocentric values, very ethnocentric interests, and they pursue them. And what's astonishing is, and this is not the only case where Jews have expressed their very self-interested, very ethnocentric motives. They've expressed them as the universal moralism. We are the good people. You know, we're here helping those people. What's nicer than that?
We're the moral conscience of the world, I've heard some of them say, actually.
They will actually say that, you know, that we are the chosen people. We are the sort of moral beacon of humanity. Use the word beacon. You know, that the Jews are the sort of light unto the Gentiles. We are the light unto the Gentiles. And that's just, you know, that's just part of this Jewish self-concept, that they're better than you, they're more moral and everything else. But when you look at what's the facts on the ground, they are the most ethnocentric people. And of course, they're prohibiting other people from coming into their country. They will not allow that.
Yeah, as we said.
That's a great headline there.
Yeah, Israel's unwanted African migrants. Yeah, exactly.
And that's typical. I mean, how many of those articles have there been?
Hundreds, probably.
Hundreds, and they ship them back by the boatload, by the airplane full. You know, they got them in prisons. There's a big prison with sky-high barbed wire in the south of Israel. I mean, this is just such hypocrisy.
If they really were genuine about their concerns, of course, they would take in much more to, I mean, let's face it, from Syria, it's much closer to Israel than to Germany and Sweden, right?
They walk across the border.
Exactly.
They don't have to get in those boats and risk their lives going across. Yeah, I mean, it's a joke. You know, it's just something that, you know, we see over and over again. And it's amazing how this just, it's just like water off a duck's back. They you can tell them this, and it's just like they doesn't register. And I think that, you know, it's a barometer of Jewish ethnocentrism. They don't understand. They don't process in their brain what's going on with that. The LA Times had a nice article on that.
Yeah, one country that won't be taking in Syrian refugees, Israel.
Right.
I wonder what that double standard is all about, Kevin. If there is a, I mean, it's been talked about this idea that there's an issue with kind of projection. There's an issue with basically never having a position that what you do is ever wrong. You do something that which is continuously in your best interests, whether that's maybe even unconscious in some instances, perhaps. But I think in many other it is conscious, right? But as soon as you begin to point out the double standard, then we're back in the anti-Semitism branch again of things, making the argument illegitimate, right?
That is right. They call you an anti-Semite for saying things are obviously true. But it's the same thing with Jewish activism in this country. I mean, there's no question that Jews were critical to the sort of transformation in racial relations in this country, funding the NAACP, getting the civil rights laws funded and passed and so on, as well documented. But again, that they portray that as being, you know, humanitarian and good and all that. But in reality, they're making an alliance with another group that they feel they can join with against white America. I mean, they see white America and white Europeans as potential stormtroopers. You know, they're potential Nazis, and they're not going to. So what they've done then is make these alliances with other groups. And so they want immigration. They want the more non-white people, the better. It's all about changing the ethnic balance, but of course, keeping their own area, you know, simply full. It's simply Jewish.
Yeah, genetically pure. It's almost a racial attitude, which could be likened to, well, in the, how they would word it, to Nazi Germany, right?
That's right. Yeah. And if you look at that, the early Zionists, they very self-consciously wanted to set up Israel because it would prevent intermarriage. They were concerned about how much intermarriage there was, say, in Germany in the early 20th century. And they wanted a racially pure area. Well, that's what they got. And in Israel, the marriage is completely under the control of the Orthodox rabbis. Conversion is very, very difficult for somebody who's not Jewish. But if you can prove your Jewish ancestry, you don't have to be Orthodox to get into Israel or marry or anything else. This is all a genetic thing. So they are very much into racial purity in Israel. And that is, again, this is one of the main reasons why Israel was set up. Concern that there was too much assimilation, too much intermarriage between Jews and non-Jews. So this is just been going on a very long time. And what they've done, though, is managed to put out the idea that it's those Europeans that are the racist ones. And, you know, and any European says, well, I'm concerned about the future of my people. I'm concerned that with all this interbreeding, we're going to lose our pure types and all that. That's just the worst sort of thing. Racist, eugenicist, all that sort of thing. But Israelis do it. In fact, there's a lot of eugenics research in Israel. They want to improve their gene pool, and they want to make it easier for people to have children who might have trouble not having. So it's again, you almost run out of words to describe this. It is hypocritical, certainly, to say the least.
Yeah, one of the big organizations, I think they're worldwide, but they're working very hard in the U.S., is HAIS. It stands for Hebrew Immigration Aid Society. They have they're very active. They're kind of, they have all these tentacles that they tie together with all these other groups or whatever. But one of the interesting things is that if you go into the Eurasian branch on their website, they have details here. Same thing there. They are detailing Greece specifically, that they're working in Greece to make sure that immigrants can come in. Ukraine as well, Austria. But interestingly enough, there's nothing about Israel here or helping refugees. Because what I've heard them say, Kevin, is that, you know, as Israelis, as Jews, we can identify as refugees, right? Because we've been the diaspora and all these things. Which is, again, we're back in the hypocrisy bracket here, because there's nothing about them aiding and helping people coming into their own country. And the excuse for that, by the way, is, well, we're a small population and things like, well, there's European countries that have much smaller populations, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, even Holland, the Netherlands, I believe, is smaller.
So they should admit a proportional number, if that's what they really think. But they don't. I mean, they just will not do that. The HIAS started out as an organization that was aiding Jewish immigrants back in the early 20th century, I believe. And then when that was not an issue anymore, they simply switched gears and started supporting anybody else coming into this country. So it's not just refugees. They want to maximize the numbers of non-white immigrants. They are one of those groups that is on, you know, the huge problem, because they well funded as usual, well organized, well connected politically. And this is a big part of the problem.
Yeah, and it's also no talk that I've heard so far of actually repatriate many of the immigrants that are coming to or the refugees, I should say, migrants, right? That they come to Europe to seek a better life. There was even, was it the National Geographic, I bet you saw the front cover, the New Europeans, of all the Syrians. They had this photo op, photo spread, I'll show it here in a minute, Just amazing, all these interviews. But these are seen as the new Europeans now. There's no talk of them ever returning to their country again. You know, no. What is this about? What is it about?
That's right. And that's in general true when they talk about refugees. They don't want them just to, you know, come there for safety and go back home. They want them to settle permanently. And everything is going to be set up in order to encourage that. They want the demographic transformation of all European countries, all countries that identify that would have been considered white countries 100 years ago. They are all targets. There's not one that has escaped this, really. And that's quite a picture from Time magazine.
Yeah, it's National Geographic's. They did a similar spread a while back on the new Americans, or how they thought that the population in America would look in 20 years or 2040 or something like that. Same thing there. It's basically, while all these other people can still have their ethnic group and their, you know, Syria is unique. I've said this before, due to the fact that, yes, it's being destroyed and bombed, but they still have a population of their own in their country. It's not like Syria is being flooded by immigrants. They can still return to Syria if they wanted to.
Yeah, the same with Africa. I mean, if you said, well, let's have an African country, I mean, they're not doing very well economically. We should, you know, import like 20 million white people, and then white people would be the majority in an African country. That would be considered the most racist thing you ever could imagine, to think that you would transform the demographics of an African country in the direction of white people. But, with this thing, this really colonization. And when you see how aggressive, especially these Muslim organizations are, they really want to impose a Muslim society. And all that means for women, all that means for the whole society, and really all that means for the biological fitness of Europeans and the end of their culture. No one can seriously believe that when whites become a minority, we're just going to carry on as we always have in terms of our institutions, in terms of our rule of law, in terms of market economies. All these things are products of Europe, European civilization, European genius. They are not going to survive when you import people from radically different cultures who are then make up the majority. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, it's true. It's very, very concerning. It's an issue that, plagues me every day. I think about it. I worry about it. I see it. I see Sweden changing, and I have this fear that it will never return back to what it was. In fact, it was actually an ad. I'm sure you saw it. This is kind of a summary of many of the things we've already covered, but it was called A New Country. Let's actually play that, Kevin. We can talk about it afterwards. This is I see it as psychological warfare. I see it as, basically imposing a vision on our European countries of basically reaching a point of no return. Let's just take a look at this.
Det finns ingen väg tillbaka.
Sverige blir aldrig som det varit.
Europa är i förändring.
Och Sverige behövs som en trygg plats för människor på flykt.
Nu måste vi söka vägar framåt och hitta ett sätt för alla att leva tillsammans.
Det är dags att inse att nya svenskar kommer att ta plats.
Med kultur, språk och vanor.
Och det är dags att se det som en positiv kraft.
Att vara svensk måste få vara mer än hudfärg och födelse ut.
Det måste få vara du, jag och alla tillsammans.
Det är inte bara nya svenskar som ska integreras.
Alla behöver integreras, även etablerade svenskar.
Integration handlar om ömsesidighet.
Låt oss skapa en framtid
som bygger på lika delar realitet och framtidstro.
Låt oss bygga ett land
där vi sätter hat och rädsor åt sidan.
Vi har alla det nya landet inom oss.
I våra synsätt, tankar och handlingar.
Det är dags att vi tillsammans formar ett land
som är stolt, inkluderande och hållbart.
Något nytt. Det nya landet.
I mean, I just see it as psychological warfare, propaganda of the highest order. There's no Swedish males hardly in this. They're talking about inclusiveness, and they're talking about how, you know, this is going to be the new vision of the country and everything else. But it's a very clear vision that, of course, just entails basically some younger Swedish women, but mostly older Swedish women, and then all these other people from Somalia and Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan and all these places. This is hate, in my view, Kevin.
It's horrifying. That video, I'd seen it before. They're expecting the Swedes to adjust to these people. And you notice they say, you got to get rid of fear. We have to hope. You know, it reminds me of Obama, hope and change. I think these liberals, people on the left, are always talking about, we have to hope for a better future. Things aren't working out right now. Sweden has become the rape capital of the world. We have, you know, high rates of crime. We have no-go areas. We have hostile Muslims who want to impose a Sharia law as much as they can, whoever they can. But it'll work out, you know, and we have to be inclusive. We have to hope that this is going to work out in the future. That's the message. And it's pathetic, and it is destructive. It's hate. Hatred against the traditional people and culture of Sweden. They are perfectly, you know, they look at that video. They are perfectly willing to jettison the entire history of Sweden and their people and their culture and sacrifice it within one or two generations on the altar of hope that this might work out. And they just hope that it will. And if you don't think it, if you have any doubts about it, well, that's fear. That's irrational.
It's like, that's you're damn right. I'm afraid, and that I'm concerned.
Should be afraid.
Exactly, should be afraid and angry and everything. This is basic idea that, you know, somehow your default emotions are wrong. They're trying to gaslight us, as I say, into this vision that you know, if you have a reaction of common sense, if you have a reaction of somehow feeling impulsively or instinctually that this is wrong. No, it's those emotions that are wrong. In fact, there's something wrong with you. We need to reprogram you. It's a form of mind control, really, brainwashing.
Yeah. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to enter your brain top down, see those images, you know, and make you feel immoral and a bad person. I think Swedes especially are very have a big tendency to be concerned about being on the right side of moral issues. They don't want to feel that they are a bad person. And that video, among many others that I've seen, they're trying to show that if you don't have those beliefs, you know, there's something wrong with you. You're bigoted. You're overly fearful. You're irrational. This is all going to work out. And it's just silly for you to be concerned that when people are oppressing women and all that sort of thing, that shouldn't be relevant anymore. That's their culture or something. It's just amazing. And I just hope in the future we can look back on this as a insane moment that we overcame. Sweden, you know, like all European countries now, in order to turn this around, it's going to have to be cataclysmic because there's so many of them there and they're so aggressive. You can't just say, well, we tried this. You got to go home now. Yeah, it's going to be very difficult, and it's going to be a huge upheaval, and perhaps only violence can really deal with it. But it's just completely unfair and to the people of Sweden that this is going on.
I think we should point out as well, Kevin, that it is violent now. It's violence against many of the local native people of these European countries and America, too. I mean, and this is just something that isn't recognized. As soon as you begin a level of pattern recognition of noticing, it's a war on noticing and paying attention, basically, you know.
So we're noticing. On Twitter yesterday, somebody posted a graph, and it's from Sweden, and it showed a chart of immigration by year, and then it showed a line of rape, the percentage of rape of going, and they're going up exactly at the same rate.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah, you know, rape is correlated with immigration, and somehow Swedish feminists are going to be the first to say, well, you know, you're a racist to oppose all this. They value diversity and inclusiveness and being on the right side of this immigration and multiculturalism issue more than the obvious interests of women. Women are the most, you know, victimized here. If you're a woman in Sweden, I wouldn't go out at night by myself.
No, and police discourage them too.
I'd be worried even with my boyfriend, unless he's got a gun and knows how to handle himself. You know, I would. You know, it's definitely something that women should be thinking about. And yet, notice that ad. It's directed at women. And women have such soft hearts. And women, even more than men, are concerned about being considered morally suspect. Women really do not want to be thought of as a bad person. And so a lot of the ads, pull at the heartstrings, you know. Oh, remember that photo of the Syrian child on the beach in Turkey who drowned? I mean, that was a sensation. And why was it a sensation? It's pulling at the heartstrings. It's, this is a victim here. It's a child.
That's right. You know?
When a child was in the street in down in Marseille, I guess it was, or Nancan, you know, the area of France where there was a slaughter, there was a child lying in the street there, run over by the truck.
Yeah, we did. We hardly saw that picture. Yeah, hardly saw that picture.
That's nothing. It's not important.
Oh, it's absolutely amazing. Kevin, we're going to continue and talk more here in the second segment. I want to take a break in a little bit. We have much more to discuss, and I want to get deeper into kind of some of the psychology of this, and then a little bit later we can return to Trump and what you see ahead here for the campaign and the potential change for that. But tell us about the Occidental Observer a little bit, Kevin, and also, of course, the Occidental Quarterly, so people know how they can support you and find more of your work.
Well, yeah, our website is the Occidental Observer. We try to publish something every day or two. Just now I put this article about Pepperdine and our advertising thing. But we've got a lot of great writers. We have an article by Andrew Joyce coming up very soon. We cover British politics quite a bit. I have two writers in England, in the UK, who are really good. And we... strongly, I think it's a great read, and the Axel Quarterly is more academic. We have a button on the Axel Observer to get to the Axel Quarterly, longer articles and so on. But a lot of the overlap, we publish a lot of the same people, and certainly the same kind of concerns, a lot of these concerns that we've been talking about on this show, concerns about the future of white America, white Europe. Is a central concern, absolutely central to what we do.
Yes, absolutely. Very good. Definitely, folks, check out the Occidental Quarterly as well. I subscribe. There's an amazing amount of good articles in there. Each, third month it comes out?
Four times a year.
Yep.
We just sent off the winter issue to the proofreader today. And so it'll be coming out, it'll be mailed out before the in the middle of December sometime.
All right, very good. Well, thank you, Kevin. We'll take a short break right here, then we'll return with more shortly. Stay with us, everybody, and we will be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, go to redicemembers.com to sign up for a membership to listen or to watch the second hour, the continuation with Kevin MacDonald, as we discuss the concerns of the hijacking of the alt-right movement and much more. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.